folks that we've been missing for a while that are back with us, some college students that we've been longing to see. We're glad you're back. Wherever you've come from, whatever's brought you here, we're glad that you're with us today. And I want to start this morning by just considering a handful of passages in the New Testament that all have something in common. I think it'll be pretty obvious what they have in common as we go through these. First, in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 13, Paul writes to the Corinthians and says, "Be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong." 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 24, writing to this same group of people, he notes that in your faith, you're standing firm. In Galatians chapter 5 and verse 1, Paul warns the Christians in the Galatian churches, "It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery." In Ephesians chapter 6, Paul writes, "Be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the full armor of God so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil." And he goes on and says, "Take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day, and having done everything, to stand firm." Of course, Paul follows that with the full armor of God. That's a text that we're probably familiar with. In Philippians chapter 1 and verse 27, Paul writes to the Philippian disciples and says, "Conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I will hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel." The Thessalonian Christians in 1 Thessalonians chapter 3, Philippians 4 and verse 1. "Therefore, my beloved brethren, whom I long to see, my joy and crown, in this way stand firm in the Lord, my beloved." And then to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 3 verse 8, Paul says, "Now we really live if you stand firm in the Lord." 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 15. "So then, brethren, stand firm and hold to the traditions which you were taught, whether by word of mouth or by letter from us." And then 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 12. "I have written to you briefly," Peter says, "exhorting and testifying that this is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it." Now, it's pretty obvious the words that are in common in all of these texts. It's the admonition to stand firm. And that implies something. Over and over, the New Testament letters are exhorting Christians to stand firm. That implies that they face pressure to be moved. It implies that they face opposition. It implies that they face influences that would push them away from the course of serving God, that would move them from the stability of their faith and their discipleship. As a good reminder that it happens in every age, we do not serve Christ in a vacuum. And we are not meant to serve Christ in some kind of sealed bubble. We serve Christ in the real world. And in every age, Christians face influences that push against discipleship. That was certainly the case for these people. It is certainly the case for us. Doug spoke a little bit earlier about a new series that we're going to be doing on Sunday mornings this fall. Stand firm. We're going to talk about being Christians in a corrupt culture, like a tidal wave that threatens to wash us away. In 1979, the theme of the Florida College Lectures was "The Godly Family in a Sick Society." That was 43 years ago, and I got to thinking about that. If folks only knew then how much sicker our society would become in the ensuing four decades. But here we are. And it's a sickness that can threaten the spiritual health of God's people. It's a sickness that can become normalized and has been in many ways. And that leads perhaps to pressure on us from our friends, our colleagues, our clients, our employers, and other people in our lives who have embraced that sickness, if you will. Now, I'm not trying to say that our culture is the worst one that's ever existed. I'm not sure how you would even begin to measure that. Is our culture more corrupt than the one Noah lived in? Let's read about his culture for a minute. Go to Genesis chapter 6. In case we need to be reminded, in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5, it says that the Lord saw the wickedness of man, that it was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth and was grieved in his heart. That's pretty bad for that kind of assessment to be offered by the inspired writer. And then verse 17, God speaks to Noah and says, "Behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish, but I will establish my covenant with you, Noah, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you." And then in chapter 7 and verse 1, I should say chapter 7, not chapter 17. "Then the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark, you and all your household, for you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time." So we're talking about an era in which Noah and his family were the only people on the planet who were doing what is right. That's pretty bad. And as I look around the world in which I live, I think, well, it hasn't gotten to that point yet. Is our culture any more corrupt than the one that Lot found himself in when he moved to the region of Sodom? Genesis chapter 13 and verse 13 makes the observation that the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. Then you skip forward a few chapters and find Lot living in Sodom, and you find God making this purpose in verse 20. "The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me, and if not, I will know." And of course, in chapter 19, angelic messengers are sent to warn Lot and his family. They said to Lot in verse 12, "Whom else do you have here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whomever you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we are about to destroy it, because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." That's pretty bad. The culture of this locality in which Lot lived became so bad that the text simply says its outcry came up to the Lord, and that the Lord sent messengers to warn the handful of righteous people who lived in that culture that they needed to get out because it was about to be destroyed. We didn't read it, but a little bit earlier we read about Abraham interceding for Sodom because he knew his nephew Lot lived there. And Abraham started pleading to God, "Lord, if you can find 50 righteous people in Sodom, will you spare the city?" And God said, "For 50 righteous people, I will spare it." But Abraham, I suspect, knew there weren't going to be 50 righteous people there. So he kept appealing to God and working the number down until he finally stopped at 10. And God said, "I will not destroy it on account of 10. But there weren't even 10 righteous people in that culture. So as one writer observed, God didn't just destroy Sodom because the sinners were sinning, but because there weren't enough righteous people to make the culture worth saving. Is our culture really any worse than that? Is it any worse, really, than the one Paul describes in Romans chapter 1? Because here's what Paul says about the dominant pagan culture of his own day, the culture that existed in his own time and had been dominant for years. "The wrath of God," he says in verse 18, "is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that is which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds, and four-footed animals, and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity. And Paul goes on in the next several verses to document the kinds of impurity and ungodliness that flowed from that rejection of God. And it's depressing reading in the next several verses. Three times in these verses, Paul says, God gave them over. God essentially let them bear the fruits of their own rejection of Him. He let them wallow in it. That's pretty bad. Is our culture more corrupt than those? I would have a hard time saying that it is, and yet there is still a great deal to guard against. Things like selfishness and lust, sexual immorality and foul language, dishonesty, brutality, injustice, godlessness, those are not new things. They've been with us for centuries, for millennia. What is new? What is new in our culture is perhaps the speed and the ease with which things like that can saturate the culture thanks to modern technology. That hasn't existed before the last few decades. And more to the point, that's the culture we live in. We don't live in Noah's day. We don't live in Lot's time. We don't live in Paul's time. We live in our time. This is the culture with which we have to contend. The culture that prevails in the United States of America in 2022. That's the one we live in. And it is affecting or infecting people we know. People we live next door to. People we work with. People we work for. People with whom we are friends. People that are our family members. Even our brothers and sisters in Christ. So we have to contend with that culture as it is. And it is corrupt. If you read in detail what Paul wrote about his culture in Romans chapter 1, you'd see a lot of familiar sights. You'd see a lot of things that you'd, that sounds a lot like our world. In 2016, columnist Mary Eberstadt coined an interesting phrase in an article of hers that really caught my attention. She talked about Christians and other social dissidents. That struck me because I had never before really thought of Christians as social dissidents. Social dissidents, well, you know, to me, that's, you know, people who are out there, you know, marching in the streets with some kind of radical political views or something else, or people who are off maybe living in a commune somewhere or something like that. People who are really just, you know, marching against the drumbeat of society. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, that's what we're doing. We are really social dissidents. The more our culture moves away from God in its prevailing mindset, the more Christian discipleship is going to appear as something radical and countercultural and maybe even antisocial. I don't think, and people have interesting debates about this, strictly speaking, America has never really been a Christian nation, but it has been a nation that gave a lot of deference to and had a lot of regard for biblical principles. It is becoming less and less and less that way as each passing day goes by. And as that happens, we will find that those of us who commit ourselves to God's way will stand out more and more from the culture around us. And we may also find that more and more animosity or even hostility may be directed toward the things we believe and profess and even toward ourselves than we've ever had to deal with. What options do we have in the face of all that? We move away. We look for a utopia somewhere. I'm not sure where we'd find it. A few years ago, I was reflecting on WalletHub's end-of-the-year survey on the most sinful cities in America. That particular year, Florida had three of the top 10, Tampa, Orlando, Miami. And I thought, well, you know, if a person wanted to get away from all that sinfulness, where would they go? And I thought of these places in America that seem like, you know, pretty idyllic kind of places, and realized that most of them were on the list somewhere too. Oh, sin may rear its head in different ways to different degrees in one community versus another, but it's there wherever you go. You can't escape from it. Are we going to withdraw into our own little community behind walls and shut out the rest of the world and live in an isolated little monastic existence? That has been the solution that disciples have sometimes pursued. I just don't think it's an effective one. And more to the point, it's not what God calls on us to do. He calls on us to live our faith out in the real world. Not to withdraw into a little one that we create of our own. Not to make a bubble around ourselves. So what do? Do we just assimilate? We just go along? Throw up our hands and say, well, if you can't beat them, join them? Lose our identity as Christians? Be absorbed into the world and its values? I think we recognize that none of those options are biblical. None of those options are acceptable for Christians. As we talk about these things this morning and often in the coming weeks, understand what we're not trying to do. We're not trying to make sweeping changes in the culture around us. We can't. We don't have the power to do that. When the elders and I were first talking about that, Doug made the comment, we're not trying to sweep back the ocean. What we're trying to do is make sure that the ocean doesn't swallow us up. That we have control over. That God has promised us grace to help with. And that requires a clear-eyed look at the corruption that's around us, the threats to our faith and our discipleship. I don't mean the threats to the integrity of the things we believe, I mean the threats to our commitment to them and our commitment to live them out. And it requires a clear-eyed look at what the biblical response to those things needs to be. God willing, that's what we're going to try to do in these next few weeks and months as we look at being Christians in a corrupt culture. For this morning, I want to look really quickly at a few things in one letter in the New Testament. It's the letter of 1 Peter. Because like much of the rest of the New Testament letters, 1 Peter is written to Christians who were or were about to suffer a great deal of hardship because they had committed themselves to Christ. They lived in a corrupt culture, and that culture was bringing pressure to bear on them to abandon their faith. That pressure was coming in all kinds of different ways, just like it does come in all kinds of different ways for us. And so it is, in a way, 1 Peter is a manual for suffering saints, a strategy for holding up instead of folding up. And Peter highlights four things. We're going to talk about these really fast this morning. Four things that make us distinct from the world, and four things that we've got to emphasize if we're going to remain distinct from the world. Number one, we have a different home. We don't have our citizenship anchored here. Peter addresses his audience, 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 1, as those who reside as aliens. Chapter 2, verse 11, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. It's a word that means a foreigner living in a strange place, an exile, a pilgrim. Peter says, we live in this world, but it is not our home. No, he says, our inheritance is somewhere else. Our inheritance, he says in verse 4, is imperishable, undefiled, will not fade away. It's reserved in heaven. That's where it is. That's where our citizenship is, as Paul expresses it in Philippians 3 and verse 20. We are citizens of a different home. That necessarily is going to make us different because our lives are not going to be all about what is going on here and what our rewards here are and what our happinesses here are. We are focused on elsewhere. And because of that, we have different values than the culture around us. We don't think like other people do. So Peter writes in chapter 1 and verse 13, "Therefore prepare your minds for action, keep sober in spirit, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance. But like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior." We don't think like others. We seek to think and act like God, who says, verse 16, "You shall be holy, for I am holy." Peter quotes there from the book of Leviticus, a book that emphasized the holiness not just of the priesthood, but of the whole nation of Israel. And now Peter says, those things apply to us. We are the ones who are God's royal priesthood and holy nation. Chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. "You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light." That's us. God has given us a brand new identity in Christ. So why should we think like the world thinks? Our home is not here. Why should we think like the world thinks? Why should we share what the world values as what we value? Our priorities are necessarily going to be different. And you know what that's going to lead to? It's going to lead to a different lifestyle. If our values and our priorities are different, then the way we talk and the way we act, the way we live our lives is going to be different. Verse 9 again of chapter 2. "You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light." How exactly do we do that? Well, we do it by proclaiming it, but we also do it by living in keeping with the holiness we profess. Verse 11. "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation." Peter adapts the word Gentiles there, not in the Old Testament sense of non-Jews, but in the broader sense of not the people of God. And he says, keep your behavior excellent among those people. And make no mistake, that's the vast majority of the people in their culture and in ours. Keep your behavior excellent among those people. Yes, they may slander you as evildoers for doing it. And we're going to talk in this series about some cases in which that's exactly what's happening. That because you and I try to do what is right, because we stand for biblical principles, we get called evil for it. Peter says that's going to happen. He says even though they do that, they may, because of your good behavior as they observe it, glorify God in the day of visitation. Early Christians were slandered, misrepresented. They were called atheists. They were called superstitious. They were called antisocial, haters of mankind, disloyal to the government because of their beliefs. A third century opponent of the Christians named Celsus accused the Christians of being ignorant, foolish, superstitious, but he never accused them of being immoral. He couldn't. He couldn't discredit their behavior. Peter gives some practical examples of how we do this. Chapter 2, starting in verse 13, we submit to those who are in authority. Even though we live in an age where people increasingly resent being subject to others in any way. Chapter 2, starting in verse 19, we endure unjust treatment if it's necessary, even though we live in a culture that is obsessed with our personal rights. Chapter 3, starting in verse 1, we show honor in our family relationships, even in a society where the very definition of family is a subject of constant debate. and where we see more of our friends and family members and brethren abandoning those very principles, we stick by them. Chapter 3, starting in verse 8, we seek to live in harmony with others without compromising our principles. We seek to avoid immorality. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. And Peter sums up the value of holiness very much as he began in chapter 1. Look at chapter 3 of 1 Peter. Chapter 3, starting in verse 13. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. Do not fear their intimidation and do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. And keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who are reviling your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will so, that you should suffer for doing what is right than for doing what is wrong. Our lifestyle is going to be different. We're going to talk about that a lot in this series, about how radically different the lifestyle of Christian discipleship will necessarily be from the prevailing culture around us. And that is going to require a different kind of courage. The courage of a disciple. Do not fear their intimidation, chapter 3, verse 14. Our values and our lifestyle are going to put us at odds with the culture around us, just like it did for first century Christians. Peter says in chapter 4 and verse 3, the time is already past. It's sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, abominable idolatries. In all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation, and they malign you, he says. Well, that's going to happen to us too. But he says, they will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. Our values and our lifestyle are going to make us different. That may lead to some degree of suffering on our part. There's all kinds of ways in which that can happen. There's all kinds of ways in which persecution can happen besides government authorities locking Christians up or putting them to death. Lots of ways in which a society can persecute people for choosing what is right. Responding to that is going to require courage. Because to a society that is bent on dismantling the family, on glorifying and retailing violence and sexual immorality, on drugging itself into a fog, and otherwise plumbing the depths of depravity, Jesus and His disciples are an irritation. But ultimately what we've got to do is recognize who the real enemy is. That's one of the challenges of responding to a corrupt culture, is remembering that the people in that culture really are not the enemy. Sometimes it feels like it. Sometimes the people in that culture are regarding us as the enemy, so we want to respond in kind. Those who may misunderstand us, malign us, mistreat us, are not the real enemy. Peter says the real enemy is Satan. The real enemy is the devil, who prowls about like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Chapter 5 and verse 8. It's a spiritual adversary we're dealing with. And that brings us back to where Peter started in chapter 1. Verse 3. Chapter 1 and verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to His great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and honor and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen Him, you love Him. And though you do not see Him now, but believe in Him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. I read that in full because Peter says it better than I could. This is the motivation for the different courage that we're talking about. It is rooted in eternal hope. It is rooted in our love for and faith in Jesus Christ, whom, even though we do not see, we love. Peter says, that's what sustains us. That's what protects us. Satan can do his worst, but he cannot forcibly take away that hope unless we surrender it to him. We're going to talk this fall about being Christians in a corrupt culture, about standing firm. I hope you'll join us for those lessons and be encouraged and challenged. This series is not meant to be depressing, although we're going to talk about some things that are depressing. It's meant to instill in us hope, what many writers have called cheerful courage. And to a point that Doy Moyer made during our Bible class this morning, one of the things we may see as our culture moves farther and farther away from God is that it makes the case for us about the value of living for Christ. As people see what a disaster sinful behavior is making of their lives, they'll be looking around for answers. And we've got those answers. So it creates opportunity for us as well as challenge. In this series, we're going to talk about the ultimate question. Is it God's authority or mine that determines how I live? That's a tougher question to answer for a lot of people than you might think. We're going to talk about God's call to holiness. We're going to talk about the principle and the cost of being distinct from the world. We're going to talk about facing various specific challenges of our culture, how to answer those things biblically, how to answer those things as we live biblically. It's going to give us a lot to think about. But those are the thoughts for this morning. Hope you've been encouraged by them. Hope you'll now turn your songbooks to the number that Phil announces our invitation song. It's number 820. We sing this song at this point in our service to offer encouragement to anybody who's present and needs to respond to the invitation of the gospel. If you're not a Christian, we hope that you will this morning repent and confess Christ and put Him on in baptism. If you are a Christian and you haven't been living faithfully, we hope this morning you will seek to make those things right, that you'll put away the things that have interfered with your discipleship, seek God's forgiveness for them, and seek the help and encouragement of God's people. Can we offer you that? Whatever we can do, whatever your spiritual need is, we make it known as we stand and as we sing together. God calling, yeah.